Hey, you're listening to World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. Today on the show, it's YOLA. Love all night, work all day. YOLA recently released her debut full-length solo album called Walk Through Fire. It was produced by Dan Auerbach. YOLA was raised in Bristol, England, but she moved to London to pursue her dreams and has been through many ups and downs along the way. She's performed in front of 60,000 people at Glastonbury with Massive Attack. But she also found herself in deep financial trouble after an expensive trip to the hospital.
I was just left with bills that I could not pay.
For a while, YOLA experienced homelessness.
That's how easy it is to find yourself living in a big kind of bag with your clothes wrapped around you in a bush in East London, you know?
YOLA talks about how she made it through and the music she made along the way, and she performs for us. She recorded these performances at Dan Auerbach's Easy Eye Sound Studio in Nashville, and she started us off with the song that opens her full-length debut solo album. This one's called Faraway Look.
The candles on the cake and threw the match down on the floor. Wish I knew what you were wishing for. Handing out the paper plate.
Performing the song that opens her debut full-length album, that is YOLA with Faraway Look. Welcome, YOLA, and congratulations on this ripping debut.
Oh, hi. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you here. The vocals on that song and the arrangement are so triumphant, and the song just sounds like it feels amazing to sing. Can you describe what it feels like to live in that song?
I definitely find singing the song is a physical thing to start with. Those big song, long notes in the chorus, they require a lot. They require a lot of air and a lot of support. So on a physical level, it's definitely high drama. And on an emotional level, it's high drama because it's about that moment in my life where I started checking out. I was feeling as though things weren't for me, like the environment was designed for another type of person to thrive. And so I just slowly started checking out, started dreaming about maybe another life.
What's the environment that you have in mind when you're thinking about the environment that you had to sort of check out of or dream yourself out of?
I was dreaming myself out of maybe a very bro-heavy environment.
Bros, like as in like, dudes, like guy-heavy environment?
Yeah, okay. But it was, yeah, just really by bros for bros environment, you know? Just, and maybe like specifically like white bro, so like double not me. Which feels really personal, but just like not designed for people like me to thrive. And that's just some environments. That's the way it is, you know, like, but you just have to make a decision as to whether you stay in those environments or not, or whether you try and make one for yourself.
I want to talk a little bit about the environment that you made this debut album in, because there are people who are going to hear it and know that it was produced by Dan Auerbach at Easy Eye Sound, and who are going to think like, Dan Auerbach discovers Yola and turns her into the thing. And that is so not the case. Like, I want it to be really clear for people from the get-go that you are somebody who has been writing, producing, arranging, singing, creating, driving your own, I guess, creative ship for a really long time. Talk to me a little bit, I guess, about the vision that you set out for yourself for your full-length debut album as Yola.
Well, I suppose the journey starts with my EP, Orphan Offering. Now, the idea behind that was for it to be small scale, just to counteract any temptation I might have to, you know, maybe dress up the idea of songwriting. I wanted to at least have one work that showed raw songwriting and raw chord structure and the beauty that that can create with some really nice sounding waves. And then on the other side, I wanted to show a big dramatic piece. So I really wanted it to be melodrama and all dressed up, all nine yards of production. So they're supposed to live together. One's supposed to be down home and rootsy, and the other's supposed to be grandiose and cinematic.
Well, before we hear more of what you did with Dan, I would love to play the song Fly Away from your EP Orphan Offering, which was the first time that I heard your voice. And this is like just a wallop of an introduction, I think, from an artistic point of view. I just remember feeling really surprised in a wonderful way about the way that this sounded. So let's have a listen to this. Like, that's so cool. that's the sort of really, really stripped down, like, songwriting at the forefront and not a lot of sonic embellishment or bells and whistles around the bones of that song. So So now I guess let's talk about how you morphed that in what you did with Dan Auerbach on this debut. Like, tell me about the first time you guys sat down to write together.
Well, the first time I sat down to write, it's worth noting that I was terrified.
Yeah?
Because it became apparent that that when we were going to start writing, that we're going to be writing in like a trio more than just me and Dan. And so I come in and, you know, we're sat down with Bobby Wood. And if you know anything about Bobby, you know, he's played with everyone. That's anyone. If you know anything about the Memphis Boys, you know. And so I told them a story about being in a house fire. And this was about Christmas 2015. And my dress caught fire, and I set the house on fire with my own body. more than the other way around, kind of thing.
What did it catch fire on? Was it like a candle or a?
Yeah, it was what they call a bioethanol burner. It was a present that I was testing out.
Oh my God.
For a friend that I, and it was fine. It worked beautifully. Only the canister that had the bioethanol, and you only drip a little bit in. It's not dramatic, but the canister was faulty. So that little drip kind of wet caught the canister. The canister blew. The drip went up my dress. My dress caught fire. And so I was a human torch for a short amount of time. And so I stopped, dropped, and rolled in a rug, pat, 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 snuff it out, get outside the door. And then I went back in and I fought the fire with a hose, with my neighbor, and the rest was history. And I think that moment was an epiphany of realization that, you know, as much as you try and rationalize kind of being in an environment that makes you feel awful all the time, you don't always consciously know that that's what's happening. And everyone will try and tell you that it's not that bad. But when you're on fire and it's the only thought that makes you feel you can get out of this because not even fire's as bad as what you got out of, then all of a sudden you feel like, you know, it gives you that clarity that one, you're on the right path, and two, any kind of naysaying, any kind of mind bending to convince you that, you know, you were foolish to try and go on your own and do this thing called music, that all kind of gets washed away or purged through fire.
Before we hear you play the song, it might be too personal, but can I ask you what the situation was that was worse than being on fire?
Well, I can be only vague in that, it was just like an emotionally horrible and kind of abusive environment. And like, I think it's not the most uncommon thing to be in an environment that is focused on maybe what I like to call the misogynoir side of things. But like, it was just really not for me. That's as far as I'm going to go with it, you know.
Sure. Well, I'm so grateful that you've come out the other side of it. And I'd love to hear you perform the song, the title track, Walk Through Fire.
Mm-hmm.
That is Yola performing the title song from her debut full-length album, Walk Through Fire. She's performing at Easy Eye Sound, which is Dan Auerbach's studio. That is also where she made the record. A little while ago, you mentioned, I guess, the need to sort of get out of a bro-y environment in the music industry. But then you find yourself like co-writing with a couple of guys on this album. I'm just thinking of that, and it's striking me as so interesting, but I think that there's something different about the way that Dan Auerbach and his crew work, I guess, than the experiences that you might have had. Dan said that you made everyone in the studio an instant believer with what you did, which is a very, very lovely thing to say.
No, it really is. That's kind.
Yeah. So can you, like, it's probably awkward to talk about yourself in this way, but can you feel when that's happening? Like, can you feel when you're doing something that's moving the molecules around you in that sort of a way?
Well, do you know what? Like, I really do try and emote as much as I can. I think the most important thing to me is that I feel something. Like in the process that I'm going through an emotional transition of some kind. And I also want to be feeling when I'm performing, and certainly when it comes to delivery. Like, I think, like, I have to do that. That's the most essential thing to me as an artist, is that I connect with what I'm singing, you know? And so, like, yeah, like maybe that's what it is. It's that need to connect, and when I do, then maybe that's what people are feeling. But I feel very much that that kind of side of being an emotional singer is something that I held in highest esteem when I was growing up and I was watching people like, you know, Aretha and Mavis. Like, I think of Mavis's delivery, and it's just nothing but compassion and complete credence. And so that's all I'm trying to do. If I manage to do it sometime, great.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the music that you would have grown up with? Like, who was playing it for you? Or is it records that were... And you grew up in Bristol, which is a couple of hours drive west of London. So were there records around the house? Or who would have introduced you to Mavis and Aretha and all of that good stuff?
Well, definitely... When I was a kid, my mother had a lot of records. And so she introduced me to Aretha. Like, well, it was our passive introduction. She also had Dolly records, and she had Elton John records. And like, I was just obsessed with this record, Young, Gifted, and Black.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't grow up with much, you know. I think I had... one bald My Little Pony because my sister tried to eat them. She loved chewing plastic, and my mum didn't want her to. She was older than me, so I had the sense not to do that anyway. And she chewed them. She loved it. And so I couldn't have one with hair because she'd probably choke on that. And so that was, I was like, that, and that was my toy. That and a box of offcuts, and a wood plane, and a red and yellow plastic handled chisel. I must have had the blue one. And I'd like, we'd like whittle stuff, or like, yeah, that's what we did. And or we'd make mixtapes. And that was like our lives. It was like music, and then going out and climbing trees, and then more music, and then whittling something, and then some more music. Like, it was fortunate that we were a kind of music-driven family.
Hmm.
It kind of really staved off the small-town boredom.
I want to talk about what happened after you left home and how you started to make your way in London once you came out as a singer, I guess. But first, we're going to hear you perform another song for us. I think this feels fitting right now. It's the song Ride Out in the Country, which to me... Well, it evokes the idea of freedom or getting out of somewhere where maybe you have less options into a place with open air. So can you tell me a little bit about writing this song?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking, I like to go horse riding. And sometimes, like, if I've been on a particularly kind of heavy run of touring or whatever, you can go back to being in the city and you still feel like that pressure is on you. And so I was talking about what I do to kind of turn my brain off. And I like to engage. I can't sit on a beach. I'd become murderous or something. I don't know. Like, I need to kind of engage, but I need to do something different. And so, like, interacting with a horse that's kind of got its own ideas about what it wants to do is like, it's a way to completely refresh your mind, you know. It gives you a different angle. And I also ride a motorcycle. And so sometimes I'll go just for like a ride out in the country lanes. And like both of those things, again, if you've ever ridden a motorcycle, you know, you've got to be aware and you have to have your head on a swivel because people are stupid. And so you, like, you're engaging in this other way, and but you're also drinking in your surroundings because you're out in it. And so like both of those things for me were massive outlets of, you know, potential overwork. There were my self-love, if you will. And so we were talking about that, and we ended up writing Ride Out in the Country.
Did you play it for us?
Oh, yeah.
Ride Out in the Country, recorded at Easy Eye Sound, performed by Yola. That is from her debut full-length album called Walk Through Fire. Tell me about making the move to London, I guess. Is that where you first started to really come out and pursue music?
Yes, it was. Like, I was always doing things in my hometown, but it was easy to disguise doing those things because, like, I could just say I was staying at a friend's house, you know? And, you know, it was also like, I was doing like club music stuff, you know? People were like, could you sing like soul vocals over this kind of track? And I'm like, yeah. So, like, they were like my first jobs, like singing with DJs. And then I moved to London with an idea of like maybe getting into the session world a little and getting some shows and going on some tours. And also I had this little side thing of actually supposed to be going to university. And I don't think I was ever really planning on going, but I did go for a week or two.
What did you take during that? What did you take during that week?
French. I did a degree in French, a minor in German.
Wow.
And I wanted to go there. I just had a picture of university being this great chin-stroking place. You're all in smoking jackets in a library, pondering the meaning of life. And, you know, dealing with, like, the big questions and, like, talking about French literature and, like, the philosophy behind it and, like, you know, it was supposed to be this place where you intellectually grew and it was just like maybe what it was in the 70s or something. But like it was just like school part two. And that broke my heart because I was done with school. I was so, so done. And so I was like, I checked out of that pretty much. My faraway look kind of came in again. And I was like, okay, I'm not here. I can pick up French. They're just going to try and test me for, like, if I know any French vocabulary, I can go to France. So I did. I got some shows in France. I became conversational in French by being in France. And I just used the rest of my student loan to kind of try and buy me some time for that year before they clearly kicked me out because I wasn't turning up. And, I think I ran out of time a little bit, a little earlier than I planned. I had a friend in my house and they had to move out. I had to go to hospital and I was just left with bills that I could not pay and a backlog of rent that got swallowed up. And that was me out on the street.
Yeah. So tell me if it's too much to talk about, but I did read in your bio that you experienced homelessness at, like, I'm assuming it's at the time that we're talking about. And I think it is really important to talk about because so many of us who live in cities have people who do not have homes are our neighbors. They live in the same places, yes, that we do, but they don't live in homes. And people are really funny about interacting with people who don't have places to live, who are also our neighbors. So can you say a little bit about your experience of that?
Yes, and I think you're right. It's so important because especially now, we're getting this massive spike in homelessness. And people that are working jobs and then going home to a tent, you know, like, it's serious.
Yeah, or people are choosing between food and shelter, like people are forced, yeah, to make those choices. Yeah.
And it's serious. And that's going to impact music. I don't think people always are aware of that. But that's going to, if that it becomes something that's rising and rising and rising, that's going to impact music. You're not going to have people that are hired up being able to afford to take the risks of getting into music and starting out on your own, you know? And so, like, yeah, my situation was way more fortunate than that, in that I didn't have a great support structure. I had that same friendship group I was talking about were all there on the surface until it came to actual support, and then, you know, I was on my own. I didn't have great familial support. Again, I was on my own. And so when that emergency state came and I was like, okay, I need some support, like, not for long, just to wait until to see if one of these jobs comes through because I've applied for a million of them. Yeah, no one was there bar one friend. And that one friend undoubtedly saved my life, you know? Mm. That's how easy it is to find yourself living in a big kind of bag with your clothes wrapped around you in a bush in East London, you know?
How scary is that? That sounds like that sounds so scary as a young woman to be in that situation.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. There's a lot of this is like a really running theme in my life. Things being terrifying, people going, yeah, but you're a strong black woman. I'm sure it was fine. And
oh my God, then, sorry. Yeah,
like it can be a real curse being perceived as strong, well, you know?
Right.
Regardless
you don't
of
get,
whether you are.
You don't get people saying that must have been really hard for you and full stop. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't get any support either. It's Jeez. Just complete neglect, and which is a mainstay of a lot of my kind of professional interactions. And once, like, you know what music's like, it crosses over into being friendships as well. And it's a kind of industry that's like that. And it's just, I've learned to see past the surface level, got your back. You know, it took a long, long time to figure that one out. But that was the lesson I learned from that. But yeah, it was a really terrifying time. And I got picked up by my friend and taken back to Bristol. And he lived in a box room, and he had all his like studio equipment in a box room and him. And he goes, well, there's space here. And I'm like, well, I'll sleep here for a night if I can stretch out. And then if I can't, I'll find something. And I stayed in another friend's like junk room. It was like everyone, if you've ever been in like a student house share and you have loads of like stuff that you've acquired or stuff that you've got rid of and you didn't want to fly tip it on the street, like you'd have like a cheap rental house and this junk room where everyone would like throw their kind of old mattresses and like broken chairs and all this business or, you know, stuff like half drum shells that you're not using anymore, all this business. Like, I was kind of on one of the old mattresses in this junk room for about 3 months.
Wow.
And that was kind of like, that was my thank heavens I have a roof situation. And that environment wasn't necessarily healthy either, but it was a start. And they were the kinds of risks that you end up taking when you're putting yourself out there. And I went back to London again, and that time it worked. Although at that point I got the job.
What was the job? Sorry.
I was working with Bugs in the Attic.
Okay, yeah.
And they were like, yeah, sure. And I was like, whew.
The band.
Thank God for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we went on tour. We did a lot of work. We went out to Australia and Asia and Europe and and then I was working and then it was fine. And that's how this works.
Jeez.
It's like you are on the floor, like you are trying to get benefits, you're trying to eat and then you're fine and you're in a 5-star hotel. I'm in a Grand Hyatt talking to James Brown. He's telling me I've got soul and this is the whole thing. And that's like how polar my life was, 21 to 22, you know?
Jeez. Can you pick a Bugs in the Attic song for us that you're really proud of to play?
Oh, let's go for Red Handed.
Yeah. So that was you taking part in the song Red Handed with Bugs in the Attic. And you also performed with Massive Attack and all of these, I think once things caught fire for you, it seems like people really, really, truly wanted to work with you.
Well, yeah, it took a little dip before that, of course, because my life is all peaks and troughs. So after that, I was like, right, I need to work because that whole being in the street thing and no one having your back thing. At the time, I put that to the back of my mind. So you have to kind of understand where I was in my early 20s self. I would choose to forget people were not there for me to make my life easier. So I could go on and be social instead of having to rehash my entire network, which I then ended up doing anyway. But hey, that's 10 years down the line. For now, I was like, do you know what? I just want to be back in the bosom of my buddies, and I'm going to forget that no one was there. Everyone had a kind of decent-ish, not really that decent reason. And that's what it was. And so I went on, I took some work. I was in a group with the Cuban Brothers, and I was just kind of doing backing vocals and stuff for a time. And that's like a, I don't even know how to describe that band other than it's like a comedy, dance, music, and something else, stand-up kind of situation. It's a live band for all intents and purposes, but at some point they're going to break dance, at some point they're going to get naked. And I had to learn to sing without laughing at seeing men's parts, and which was an amazing skill to acquire.
You put that on a resume for sure. People would be really, really impressed.
Yeah, yeah. I could not burst out laughing whilst looking at Dee. Just deal with that. And and he was like a naturally hilarious person. And so that was a really great, fun tour to do. And so I was just taking work, taking work, taking work. But then I lost my voice. And I was out for about a year and a half singing.
My goodness.
And I couldn't speak for 2 months. And when I came out of that, I was like, well, you're going to need to work again. And a massive attack. We're looking for somebody to fill in because their vocalist, who they usually worked with in America, was ill. And I was like, well, I need to do this. And they'd been started, one of them had started working with one of my co-writers in my local band. And so we kind of started writing a little bit. And then they were like, do you want to come on the road? And I'm like, hell yes, I need work now. I can sing, my voice is working again. And so we did like all of these beautiful places. And it was in the middle of the tour, but we played Glastonbury on the other stage to about 60,000 people, the kind of headline set. And again, I was back on the top of the world. And this is just what it is. It seemed to be the pattern, just like up and down and up and down. And so although my walk through fire was kind of Christmas 2015, I've been kind of going through kind of, you know, various proofs through fire, you know, my whole career.
Yeah, trial by fire indeed. And just this, like, I mean, it's interesting what you said about people's expectation that you have to be a strong Black woman, because when we talk about it, like, all of the stuff that you've been through makes you incredibly strong. But I think being able to be honest about the hard times of it, or being able to go to those vulnerable places, is what makes you a wonderful songwriter, human being also, but like a really wonderful songwriter. Do you know what I mean? I want to ask you, I guess my last question that I have for you is your thank yous on your debut album. I was struck by looking at your liner notes. You have like the longest list of thank yous and the most the most like detailed, heartfelt thank yous I've seen. And the whole story that you've told, and loyalty and friendship and people who are helping you out or people who have disappointed you, just like gratitude and relationships seem like they're really important. So I'm sorry. I tell
it's
me why you're
everything.
Yeah.
You're right. It's everything to me. Like, you could put me, you know, in this millionaire band doing this fabulous thing. And I call that thing the ivory tower of misery if you don't have that human quality around you. That's, you can't, do you know what I mean? There's no, that's the greatest currency to me, is just trust and human quality and quality relationships. And everyone I'm working with is so high quality, it makes me want to cry on the regs. And And that's what I've been working towards. That's what I've been looking for this whole time. First 30 years of my life, I'm a 35-year-old woman, you know. first 30 years of my life, complete neglect. And so every time I see it, you know, like, you know, I had moments of just kindness and lovingness, and I have connections that I've reconnected with people who are just high quality. But I always got drawn away by people that had a plan for me as opposed to, you know, wanting to truly collab and like be part of a journey of me actually growing, you know. And so it's just so important to recognize those people at every stage, you know.
Well, I'm so glad that you have that. You have one more song to do for us, and it's called Love All Night. Anything you want to tell us about the song before we hear you perform it?
Oh, yeah. That's, for me, this song is about the grind. It's about being the kind of artist that's had to work all day doing a job so that you can do what you love the rest of the time. And I used to do all sorts of crazy jobs, like call centers and a dishwasher and all sorts of jobs kind of in the early days when I was in Bristol. So it's going out to, it's an ode to those people.
Love all night, work all day. Ain't nothing wrong with living day to day. Something's wrong, we gotta make it right. We gotta help one another just to make it.
That is Yola with Love All Night, recorded at Easy Eye Sound, Dan Auerbach's studio, where she made her full-length debut album. It's called Walk Through Fire. Yola,
Thank you for sharing your incredible talents with us, and best of luck with your full-length solo debut. We love it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You're listening to The World Cafe.
Yola's full-length debut solo album is called Walk Through Fire. Thanks so much to Yola for being here to perform for us. Thanks also to John Myers, our producer, who did a lot of work on this session. I really appreciate it. And I'm Talia Schlinger. You're listening to The World Cafe.